Awesome. Hey, imaginary internet audience. Welcome back to another exciting Mile Wide Club. And welcome back to the Mile Wide Club. The first person to come back to the Mile Wide Club. What? Jacob DeNoble, world's foremost Vin Diesel scholar. And we're talking about the Final Destination franchise. So, among your many areas of expertise is do you prefer thinking of them as franchises, or do you prefer thinking of them as series?
I like the word franchise, but you know, now that I say it out loud, it sounds a little too corporate, and I don't know, maybe series fits things like the, you know, Francis the Talking Mule series sounds much more reasonable than Francis the Talking Mule franchise.
Part of why I'm interested in that distinction, right, is I think Final Destination becomes extremely franchisey.
Yeah, I have not read any of the print material, but I am kind of dying to read some of these novels.
Dying to read about people dying, as it were. Yeah, I mean, horror franchise as a thing is sort of something that I'm interested in because it, and I don't think this is especially true of horror movies, but I think I would like to claim that it's especially true of horror movies. That once you have something with a solid premise out there in the world, it feels very likely that it's going to turn franchise.
I think that's definitely true. And it's kind of interesting with horror, though, because like, it seems like that runs counter to what you would assume horror does, because horror is kind of about the fear of the unknown and kind of making you uneasy. And with a lot of these horror series, it then very quickly becomes a formula that you actually participate in and enjoy. So, like, the idea of, you know, the slasher films, and, you know, the Final Destination, half the fun is you know exactly what a Final Destination movie is going to be from start to end by the time you sit down in your seat. The, you know, this didn't start off trying to be a series.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it lives up to kind of, it lives up to the 80s slasher series better than I think almost anything else does. No, nothing else really captures that sense of fun and, you know, regularity, like The Final Destination, or even like Saw does.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a lot of movies that have, like, actively tried to do that, you know, like Hatchet and, you know, a few other things that have, like, been like, oh, well, this is going to be a throwback to the 80s kind of slasher stuff, and it never just feels right. And I think it's kind of helped by the fact that this didn't start off trying to be that. And in fact, isn't really a series until you get number two, which then realizes, oh, this is something that is repeatable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I don't know how much you know about the origin of the series. But so this actually started life as an X-Files spec script. A guy just submitted this to, you know, the X-Files writing crew and said, hey, here's an idea that maybe Mulder and Scully could investigate, you know, plane crash, people start dying one in a row. And two of the, like, head writers of the X-Files liked it so much that they just kind of whisked it away from the first guy and said, you know, hey, we want this to be our, like, directorial debut. We want to turn this into a film. And I feel like you can still see the bones of an X-Files episode in that first Final Destination movie, because you have the two FBI guys who are, you know, investigating the whole thing, and you could easily see that exact story told from their perspective, trying to figure out, is this actually happening or not, instead of, oh, this is definitely something that is happening.
I think, is the first one the only one where death sort of covers its tracks a bit? Because I know there's the bathroom death of the most likable character in the whole movie. He is. He's sort of endearingly useless. But
I'm sorry, Sean William Scott doesn't die until later.
Okay, well, fair enough. But where the water sort of retreats backwards, which feels very X-Files-y to me. So that origin is sort of interesting because it's death as a force is something that our mutual friend and Twitter mutual Ariel was pointing out as much more appealing to her, to have death be the sort of cause of death, as it were, versus the serial killer movies.
So that's definitely actually what I like about the Final Destinations more than I like about pretty much any other slasher franchise, is that death as a force, being the killer, actually allows them to play with themes about death in a very legitimate way, because it's forcing teenagers who generally think of themselves as invincible or think of death as something that is so far off, it forces them to confront the fact that, like, oh, you are going to die. That is something that will happen to you and everyone you know. And the Final Destination movies are literally just what's happening to all of us, just on an accelerated timescale.
I do sort of question your definition of teens as, like, not expecting death momentarily, because all the teens I knew when I was a teen were very death fixated, hang out in the graveyard. Okay,
maybe it depends on your teens, and you actually, I guess, see that in the franchise when you get the goths in part three, who are very interested and compelled by death. But yeah, that's the old saying, though. You know, the kids think that they're invincible. They do dumber things because they feel like they can, and nothing will happen to them.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that the conjunction between youth and death is a fraught one, and one that has been rich literary grounds, for one, and then also engaging with that as not incited by a person is going to be significantly different than, like, the sort of freak implausibility of a slasher movie.
And it's interesting, because in Final Destination films, more so than in other slasher franchises, in each episode, you watch the characters go to funerals or memorials,
yes,
which is something that very rarely, like, you know, there's no time. If you're at summer camp and Jason lops your friend's head off, they don't take a break to then, like, go to a funeral. And so it's just interesting to me that in each film, you get very different views on what death means and what you should do with your life knowing that death is coming for you. So in some of the films, you know, it's very much built around this concept of how do we beat this? How do we stop this? How do we live longer? And then in others, like in Final Destination 5, the characters are very much like, well, if I'm going to die, I might as well do these things that I wanted to do before that happens.
YOLO, as the kids say. I don't actually think the kids say that anymore. I think the kids stopped saying that. I sort of disagree that it is very different. I absolutely agree that sort of explicit negotiation between what does one do with the understanding, the very concrete and the very sort of observable understanding that life is limited. You're absolutely correct that they stage that negotiation, but I think they tend to stage it in its plurality. Rather than any given movie taking only one stance on it.
I could see that. I was thinking more about your lead vision havers.
Mm-hmm.
Or, so, you know, Final Destination 2 is very much about Claire having to try and, you know, confront the fact that she might be able to live longer and stay safe, you know, within the confines of the institution which she's committed herself. Or she can go out and try and help as many people as she can with the time that she has left.
Yeah.
And that's not always something that comes to play in the films. It's interesting because sometimes the rules even kind of fall in and out depending on what the movies want to really pay attention to. Like in Final Destination 5, they just completely leave out the idea that if you save someone, that it skips them.
Yeah, and they add in, instead you can do a murder. I thought was a delight. Did they decide that having death kill people wasn't enough killing people? Okay. I mean, you're absolutely right that there is a difference in perspective. Sort of how sympathetic the Vision character is also varies pretty tremendously.
Yeah. Sometimes they're just complete non-entities, and I think that's definitely true in, like, 2 and 4, where, like, I can barely remember who had the vision.
Yeah! 4! I think 4 is an interesting case, because I loved it in its genericness. Nothing about that movie felt particularly concrete. It felt more like a slasher movie than any of the rest of them. But it did, maybe because it was so late in the franchise, it did really start to feel like character had receded far into the background.
Yeah, and so one of the interesting things, I think, about the franchise that you don't really see in other franchises is just the weird pattern of directors that you get for the first four.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this alternating switch where James Wong does 1 and 3 and then David Ellis does 2 and 4. And I think they both bring very different but complementary perspectives to, like, what they think the franchise should be about. And I think, you know, Ellis is very much... The move 2 and 4 are shot, you know, they're very brightly lit. The world is very... It's the world as it looks, or even heightened a little bit. Then 1 and 3 are very much, they're very dark. They're very trying to sell the concept of death as this entity that they want to visually represent as something that is kind of weighing over everyone. Mm-hmm. Whereas 2 and 4 are very much, death is outside in the natural world as you would see it, and it can get you at any time.
I don't know that I felt that 2 and 4 were particularly naturalistic in their staging, but...
Well, naturalistic is completely the wrong word. it's hard to put into words, but just how poppy and candy-colored and...
That is something that I strongly felt. I felt like they were very slick. I felt like they were much more blockbustery than 1 and 3. That felt, to me, almost more X-Files aesthetic-y, even, where it's... Mm-hmm. A little bit grimier. Yeah, I mean, I think dark is right. I think color-wise and in terms of, like, how they set things, too. I feel like 1 and 3 do a lot more with interiors. And, like, I don't think that precludes your observation about, like, death is a natural force that's sort of out there and could be coming at any time versus a, like, malevolent, supernatural, brooding force, which is... how I might make that distinction. It just, like, sudden versus, like, lurking. If Final Destination is able to sort of alternate this sort of spookier take versus this more violent take, I think that's interesting. And also sort of reflected in what I kept ineptly coming back to, and, like, I still haven't put my thumb on it. But the idea of what I think of as the two kinds of Final Destination deaths, where one is very elaborately set up, and one is, like, shit falls from the sky and fucking kills you, you're dead. And often the very elaborate ones get foiled, which I recognize as a pacing thing. But sometimes they don't. Like, in the first one especially, what's-his-name actually dies of that elaborate setup in the bathtub. Versus the LASIK in 5, which does not kill her, and did freak me the shit out.
5's deaths are pretty gnarly. The gymnastics death, I think, is one of the more gruesome ones, for being as sudden as it is.
That one is within sort of... It's so Looney Tunes that it's a little funny. Whereas the... Was it 2? Where the mean girls get roasted? Or it was 3, wasn't it? Where the mean girls get roasted to death? Yeah, because teens.
And please, let's not besmirch the good names of those two. Because one of the things that I actually really love about their characters is that they're portrayed as... kind of, you know, ditzy and dumb, but they're also really kind, and I don't know, that's something that always stuck out to me. Like, they see that Mary Elizabeth Winstead's having a hard time, and they're like, hey, if you want to come, like, go tanning with us, please do, we want to look out for you. And I don't know, it's one of those things where I think a lot of the Final Destination characters, they give them just, like, an archetype, and then they'll just throw, like, one extra personality, like, piece at them, as if that would make them a well-rounded character. So it's like something that you would just, like, a stock character, and then they go, oh, but also, weed-smoking guy, you know, doesn't want his mom to find his porn.
Oh, God, I was so shittily affected by that. I'm such a chump.
It's a really touching moment.
Yeah, it kind of is, though. I feel bad that I was like, oh, no, that guy. And they're pretty...
Just like the security guard who, you know, is also an alcoholic because he killed someone, like... They're constantly giving you these characters that you see in every horror movie and then just, like adding just one note next to them.
Saying because he killed someone is a little unkind to my beloved calling his mom security guard.
He actually gets, I think, what is probably the best of the surprise kills in the entire franchise.
Mm-hmm.
In that a lot of them are paced very much in a way that if you watch a lot of these kinds of movies, you can feel that in quote-unquote unexpected death is coming up, like when the girl is walking across the street and gets hit by the bus in the first one, or the way the plate glass window falls on the kid. Those are surprising moments, but very much within the rhythm of what an action, of what a horror movie considers surprising. But he's like mid sentence, and it's not framed in a way that you would expect something to be coming out of nowhere. It's just so casual and so just like horrific because he is truly the only like character that you even like left in the film.
Yeah, the rest of them are just like, y'all can die. Maybe that's just me. Which is where it's interesting when they do manage to make it affecting. As, for instance, Security Guard Man. But also a little bit in Final Destination 3, I guess, where they've, like, made it out and then Hell Train comes and does Hell Train things.
Mm-hmm. I love that they just throw away an extra, like, opening movie disaster at the end of that one.
Right?
Like, they know they're making a franchise, and they're like, all right, well, this one's going to be the roller coaster one. And I guess we got NASCAR coming up next. Oh, what? Yeah, let's just burn train death. You know, that won't come in handy later.
We don't need it. We'll just get that out of the way. Although, I guess Final Destination 5 does a lot of sort of recapping the greatest hits. So, no death is truly wasted when you can bring it back for Final Dest 5.
It's so odd that Final Destination 5 does such a great job summing up the series, considering that the fourth one was supposed to be the final one. And the fifth one, they fully expected to make sequels to and just have never gotten around to it.
Because Final Destination 4 doesn't feel like a last movie in a franchise.
Yeah, it's just, it's kind of like, you can see where they thought it would be, because it's kind of like, hey, this is just a big celebration of everything Final Destination is, and it's going to be in 3D, but, like, they kind of do that celebration so much that they forget to actually be, like, a Final Destination movie, if that makes sense. Like, it's having so much fun playing with these concepts that they forget to, like, make it a little bit scary.
Yeah, that might be part of what I liked about it, because it's very splattery.
One of the things, though, I think as the series goes on, and I think 5 is particularly notable for this, and I think it's a little disappointing, but I could see, depending what you want out of it, enjoying it. Mm-hmm. But I think the deaths become less, I think this is a hot button word for you, but they become less relatable. They become less things that you come across in everyday life. And I feel like the first two particularly, in the Final Destinations, all of the deaths are built around things that you do with regularity. Mm-hmm. And after you turn the movie off, every time that you have a mug of water next to your computer, or every time you go to the dentist, or every time you do one of these things that you do all the time, you think back to Final Destination and you get that fun little jolt. But by 5, it's like acupuncture and laser eye surgery and gymnastics, and it becomes much more where they're trying to think of, what are those situations where we could kill people most spectacularly, not necessarily the kind of situations our viewers will find themselves in after they go home?
For once, I think this is a good use of relatable, because I think part of the bit of the franchise is absolutely pointing out the ways that everyday situations become deadly. I imagine tanning beds were a plausible death threat in the early aughts. I don't think anybody does that anymore, but...
Well, the thing about tanning beds is they're going to kill you anyway.
Yeah, it's true.
I took some notes. I wrote down some concepts. And so I think one of the things about Final Destination that I think is its greatest strength and maybe a missed opportunity, mm-hmm, is that it's so consistent.
Mm-hmm.
For 5 films, you get exactly what they offer on the tin. There's never one that like goes completely off the rails. And slasher franchises.
Well, the train one went off the rails. Okay, sorry, carry on.
But like slasher franchises are notorious for this, where, you know, they go, all right, well, we can't just do the same thing over and over again. We got to bring in something new, and then they bring in something new that is also bad.
Yeah.
And then they go, oh no, we got to go back to basics. So, you know, you get like Michael Myers being a cult, whatever, or Jason going to hell and possessing people. But so I wrote down some concepts that I'm surprised Final Destination never did. I am surprised they never went to a unique location. There's never like a beach party Final Destination. There's never Final Destination in Tokyo, Final Destination in a prison. They never go back to the past. That was apparently the pitch for Final Destination 6, which I think sounds awful, which was it was going to be in medieval times.
Oh my god, that sounds amazing. They don't die of the fucking plague.
But I mean, medieval times, people died at 22 anyway. Like, what is your film? I'm surprised they never got more into the lore. You never find out why people are getting premonitions. You never figure out, is there another force that is trying to save people?
Mm.
And then you never find out anything more about Tony Todd. What is Tony Todd as the mortician? Because he's great, but he pops in and out of the movies. And the ones that miss him, I think, really do miss him.
Yeah, yeah.
And every time you see him, he comes up with a new rule that he didn't tell anybody else.
Right?
Which, I've never really understood why he does that. I guess given what we know about the end of Final Destination 5, maybe that is what taught him, hey, I shouldn't tell people about the murder rule. Can we get into the end of 5, though? Because it was maybe the most excited I had ever been in a movie theater when the end of that movie came up.
Yeah, do you want to talk through that?
So, Final Destination 5, for those of you who have not seen it, and shame on you, it feels very much like 3 and 4, which are standalone stories. They have no real connections to the first two films, which are tied pretty closely together. They have recurring characters. They're all based out of the same disaster. It turns out that they're all one long storyline. And Final Destination 5 goes on for most of its runtime like that. But the characters keep talking about going to Paris, which is where Devon Sawa and crew were going in the first film. And then at the end of the film, they get on the plane, they've survived everything, and they look up, and it's slightly CG-altered footage from Final Destination 1 as Devon Sawa and Kerr Smith are fighting on the airplane, and they get taken off, and twist ending, the best twist ending since The Sixth Sense.
It was so good.
This entire movie has taken place in the year 2000, and not 2011, when it was made, and it has all been a prequel to the first Final Destination. So in rewatching it for the podcast, I wanted to see, you know, are there clues? Could somebody have guessed this is what's happening? But there's a few things that will tip you off. And one is that the coupon that the guy is given to the massage parlor it expires in the year 2000. They all have their flip phone cell phones. But the best one is the cult pop culture references that get made in the film. The first one that happened, I thought, that's kind of a dated reference. And then I realized, oh, right, this movie's in the year 2000. And it's when the laser eye surgery girl comes out and she forgets her glasses and her boyfriend goes, here you go, Lisa Loeb. And I was like, whoa, hey, Lisa Loeb, this makes perfect sense. And then later a guy does a I See Dead People Sixth Sense reference, which again is something that, you know, is popular enough that somebody would be doing in 2011. But in the year 2000, would be right on the button for what folks are talking about in pop culture. And yeah. Those are just two clever moments. I thought those were clever.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you said they don't go back in time, but they do go back in time to the year 2000, so.
You have got me there.
I did sort of want to ricochet us back towards relatable for just a second, because it did remind me of what a friend was saying about how as she has a lot of anxiety, and she felt like Final Destination was very, like, accurate to what that experience is. So they're both relatable deaths in that, like, it's they're very plausible ways to die. But the specific ways that they're implausible, I think structurally the deaths, the ways that it's, like, if this thing leads to this thing leads to this thing leads to this thing, we could all be fucking dead, is a specific anxiety thought pattern.
Well, that's interesting because when you... The two characters that really kind of survive and go through the whole thing, which is Devon Sawa in the first one, and then Ali Larter in 1 and 2, Clear and Alex, I think his name is.
I think so.
It's fun, it's interesting to see the way that their characters evolve. Like, when Devon Sawa is holed up in that shack and is trying to death-proof it and trying to find every possible thing that would get him. And I think that's one of the scenes where the movie actually starts to transition into more of an overt comedy than it is at the start, where, like, he's sitting there and the fishing pole comes out and the, like, needle, like, almost gets him and he looks at it and he's rusty. Tetanus. You almost got me. Good one, Death. Like, just a very funny moment. I don't know, it's just interesting to see the way that, I guess, in terms of anxiety, to see characters try and control their environments. The way that Clear, when they're in the gas station, is just like smacking the guy who's trying to smoke a cigarette there.
There's a scene in, I guess it is Final Destination 2, where they're sort of death-proofing the apartment as a group. And then there's one in 5 where the couple is like taping up the knives in their house. Very much something that comes back, although it's not always played to the same comedic effect as with Sawa. I think when I was watching Final Destination 1 with Aaron, we kept getting distracted by how sweaty Devin Sawa is that whole fucking movie. That was sort of the character arc that I noticed for him, is he starts out medium sweaty and he ends up extremely sweaty. There are very few scenes where he is not gleaming with fear sweat, but...
While we're on Sawa, I'd like to talk a little bit about the cast and how that kind of changes as the franchise goes on, because the first one is very much living in that world of 90s horror, your post-Scream horror films, where they're very much being cast with faces that are recognizable to the teen audience. So you've got Devin Sawa, you've got Kerr Smith from Dawson's Creek, you've got Sean William Scott, you've got Ali Larder, who just came off of Varsity Blues. And that very much plays into what horror movies of the late 90s were trying to do. So you had, like, Jennifer Love Hewitt in I Know What You Did Last Summer. You've got Josh Hartnett in Halloween H2O. But as the franchise goes on, they realize that the star of the movie is the concept. Death is what people are coming to see. Mm-hmm. And they kind of, you just lose recognizable faces almost entirely, except for Mary Elizabeth Winstead in Part 3, but she became famous afterwards. And I guess David Koechner in Part 5, who every time I watch it seems so out of place just because he is a recognizable face in a Final Destination movie, which is something I'm not usually used to. And it's interesting, though, that Final Destination is the one of those franchises that actually did survive past the second film. Because, you know, you've got I Know What You Did Last Summer, they come back for one more, and then it dies. You've got Urban Legends, I think Tara Reid, and that came back for a single sequel, and then that franchise died. The Halloween came back for one more, and then they had to reboot it 10 years later. Yeah. Final Destination is really the only horror franchise that kept cranking along throughout the, like, 90s and 2000s, pretty much until Saw comes around.
Yeah. Saw is also powered much more by its premise than anything else. It is deeply and exclusively premise-y. Not that Scream at all lack premises. You know, there's premise-y, yeah. And then there's premise-y.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, the premise of most of those films is somebody is going to murder you for various reasons. That's yeah. Not like a whole hell of a lot of a premise.
They might be less premise-y and more sort of set dressing-y, where the thing that makes them click along as a franchise is sort of the accessories with which murder is did, rather than the sort of way that the deaths themselves are organized and executed, which is, I think, what links, to me, Final Destination and Saw.
One of my favorite things that seems to happen over and over again in the franchise, and I think kind of plays into some of the themes that interest me, at least, I think characters are constantly sure that they've finally figured it out. Or they think they've figured out Death's plan, or they just say a rule and assume that that's right based on no information whatsoever. And they're consistently proved to be wrong, partly as a way to just, you know, murder everybody at the end of the film, but yeah. Partly, I think, out of kind of this idea that they say Death has a plan, and, you know, maybe there are some things that you can track, but really, nobody knows what exactly is going on. And sometimes that makes it more compelling, but sometimes, like, in Final Destination 3, I think one of the frustrating things about that movie for me is that, structurally, we as an audience know that saving someone does not save them forever.
Yeah.
Because we've seen that in 2 films. But the characters in Final Destination 3 do not know that and assume that that is correct. And so you get this fake happy ending at the end where they're like, we're all safe. And I don't know, it takes a lot of the steam out of the climax, just for me, knowing that, you know, they're trying so hard, but it's like, you guys aren't actually doing anything. You're just spinning your wheels until death comes for you again. And I think trying to come up with a climax for Final Destination movies is tough because of that idea that you can't actually stop death. Because what makes the end of a movie beyond the fact that it's like, oh, we're almost out of people, so I guess this is like, this is the climax. Whereas in a slasher movie, it can be like, ah, it's the final showdown between your heroes and your villains. But this one is just, every time the movie ends, it's just like, oh yeah, we ran out.
Just gotta run down the people clock, yeah. And that did start to feel like it was an element of the premise, is once you think you beat death, death comes back and oh boy, it's splat time. Viz, they reconvene in the train, they reconvene in the coffee shop, and then get splattered by a truck, and I think four, which in retrospect, neat that they dodge vehicular death and then die by vehicular death. That's kind of cute. And then, of course, in Final Destination 1, it's when they reconvene in Paris that they get squished. That started to feel not so much like it was a fake happy ending, but that it was a necessary element of what Final Destination is doing, to say once you let your guard down again, that's when it's death time.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's an insurmountable problem, because I think 2 and 5 actually do a pretty good job at trying to come up with a reason for a certain sequence to be the end of the film. So in 2, you know, they have the idea that, oh, well, we've got to get this baby born, and then when that doesn't actually work out, they have a goal that they're given and they're trying to achieve, and that at least feels like, that feels like something beyond just like, oh, well, we've got to save Sharon, and then Sharon just dies anyway. And then 5, I'm very fascinated by, because they introduced the idea of a human villain, which is something that you don't really see, and then so all of a sudden this guy has to dodge death both from this mysterious force, which is heating up a gun to shoot him on a stove, and then also his former best friend.
The gun heating is so fucking funny somehow.
I like the idea that death is just like, I've had enough. Just give me a gun. I'll shoot them.
Actually, death is getting sort of frustrated with the whole thing. It's an appealing thought, because it sets up the whole elaborate dentist thing. There's an intervention, then it's just like, fine, I'll just drop the roof on you. I don't give a shit. Like,
well, it's funny. I wrote that down as a note, like, during one of the early films, where I was like, oh yeah, there's some point in this franchise a character mentions that it looks like death is mad at them, and that's why these deaths are so gruesome. But I don't think that actually does ever come up. I think I might have just made that up. But it's fun to think, like, death is perturbed that its plan has been screwed up. So it's like, yeah, I'm going to, like, chop your head with a car motor that jumps out of the front of a truck.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a large part of this, is there are series where they try to make slasher deaths upsetting, or there are series where it's wacky. But every single time someone got an increasingly wacky cause of death in a Final Destination, it was just hilarious.
I mean, Final Destination 2 is, to date, pretty much the only horror movie my mom has ever, like, wanted to watch. I think it's very much part of it. It's that, you know, these deaths, they're long setups, but they're often quick payoffs, which makes the ones that aren't and stand out more. So like, it makes the horrible needle scene in Final Destination 5, you know, really stand out, because it's a character really in pain, which is something that you actually don't get a lot of in Final Destination. People are so rarely just in pain. It's usually like, I am alive, no, they are dead now.
Yeah, that's true. There's a couple of strangulations.
Yeah, and the tanning bed is one that I think is particularly gruesome. The tanning bed death kind of makes me a little uncomfortable, because it feels mean-spirited in a way that Final Destination doesn't usually to me. It's lingering on death, and also lingering on nudity in a way that I don't feel entirely comfortable with.
They don't usually combine the mandatory Final Destination tit scene and the death scenes. Like, every Final Destination has a mandatory tit scene, which usually is someone who is not actually involved in becoming dead. Usually they just roll through, do a flash, and get on with their lives. I like to think they buy death off that way.
Yeah.
I think in the first one, it's just a magazine, but otherwise, like, somebody comes through and that's it. But
oh, God, I forgot about Devon Sawa, like, jerking. That's an interesting... I'd like to dig into that more in a second.
Yeah, absolutely. Please dig into Devon Sawa jerking off. Yeah, I think that's where your sort of redemption of the dits is interesting. I think that one and the needle scene stick out to me because they feel like we're being shown a character getting their comeuppance in a way that in needle scene, like, he definitely deserves it. We've just seen him being super racist. Like, you know, it's their entitlement that sets up their death in a way that in almost every other murder, I feel like it's avoiding dying that causes their death. Like, in almost every case, it's intervention to avoid death that, like, sets off the chain. But,
you know, that's an interesting way to think about a lot of the deaths in Final Destination 3. Mm-hmm. Because you also have the guy working out.
Mm.
The sword comes and cuts the two things, and he's fine until he decides to, like, get really aggro about it and pull it down again, and the weights come up and smash his own head.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And, like, I love those shitty fucking goths so much.
The nail gun scene is a similar thing. You know, they're shooting pigeons with a nail gun.
Yeah.
At the end, that's what gets her.
Yeah. Those ones felt much more, like, karmically earned. So, I was dead-ass wrong. In many of them, it's trying to avoid death that, like, sets off their death. But for some reason, Final Destination 3 is like, fuck a team. They all deserve it. The reason the goths stick out is partly because the kid with the same name as the high school is supposed to be what's-her-name's cause of death for a second. So that's another human antagonist for a bit. Is they really do set him up as, like, he's gonna go to murder town. I don't know. I didn't have a further thought on that aside from, like, I wanted...
I like when you do get these characters who just... really do break down at the thought that this is something that's actually happening, and it's that death is just so overwhelming that they just cannot handle it. And I think that's what you get with both him and then the guy in Final Destination 5, where, you know, his girlfriend is killed.
Yeah.
And it's just something that's just so upsetting to them that they just completely abandon any reason.
I guess also Train Tracks guy in Final Destination 1.
In each one of those instances, it's based on their girlfriend's dying, though.
That is
true. Which I'm just now realizing.
Yeah. I would have been interested in seeing that go the other way around as well. But...
the closest thing you get is the mom whose kid dies, but she doesn't, like, start attacking other people. She's just like, well, if I'm going to get crushed by plate glass, too, I might as well. I've got nothing else to live for. She gets the hook hand guy, who is a real... That's a character to just throw into the middle of your movie. A guy carrying a bunch of hooks who likes to smell people's hair.
Yeah, he was a charmer. I was really glad that they gave us that guy to sort of carry in our hearts for always.
I do love, though, that, like, when she does, like, get trapped in the elevator, he does legitimately start trying to help, like, oh god, this is a horrible thing that's, like, I feel like it would have been easy to make that guy just be like, he's the creep, and he's just gonna be like, ha-ha, what's going on?
Yeah,
like,
it would have been very...
Oh, no, there's a horrible situation. I guess even the creeps are gonna at least try to help out.
It would have been very easy to make a man who sexually harasses a stranger unsympathetic. It's astonishing that they chose to do otherwise.
I'm not saying he's a sympathetic character.
Yes, sorry.
I'm not asking for Hook Hand Man spinoffs.
Are you sure? Are you sure you don't want a Hook Hand Man redemption arc? I think it's... It would have been stunning to me if they had had... Like, how are you going to do that? How are you going to have Hook Hand Man just be like, okay, like, cool, she got beheaded. How is he going to smell her hair if her head's been ripped off? I could see you making a connection there to the sort of characterization of the unsympathetic jock in Final Destination 3.
I was going to say, the teenness of Part 3 is interesting because it does feel like it's retreating back to what the first film was, which was a group of high schoolers who all knew each other. one of the things that I truly love about part two is that it introduces a group of teenagers that you assume are going to be the survivors and then kills them all off except for the one. And then introduces a group of strangers who range in age from, you know, a small child to adults to a pregnant woman to... You get the survivor group that actually hangs out in part two in a way that it, they don't in any of the other films. And that, I think, is kind of a missed opportunity. So, like, they have that room that they're trying to anti-booby trap.
Yeah.
Reverse Home Alone. And it allows them to get all of the boring, like, oh, hey, here's what's happening. Death is killing us. It's all happening in the order. No, it's not. Blah, blah, blah. I don't believe you. Blah, 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 blah. And in all the other films, they do that one character at a time, and it gets a little repetitive. But in two, they just kind of throw that all out at the beginning, and then they all move as a pack throughout the rest of the film, which means that you get sequences where multiple people can die, which is something that doesn't really happen again. You get, like, you know, in the other ones, it's, oh, well, this is the tanning bed death. This is the department store death. This is the, you know, but, like, they have that field where it's like, oh, well, the lady gets the airbag and her head explodes, or the guy gets chopped in half by a fence, and that's all in a singular location. And I think that's an interesting way to do it that feels a little less formula, and it feels a little more like a flowing story.
Two did have the handful of dissenters who tried to leave the group and who therefore died that way. Notably, I wasn't clear on if he was a high school teacher or a, like, non-tenure faculty at a university. He was grading blue books. And the...
Oh, Motorcycle Man?
Yeah, Motorcycle Man.
Apparently, they say he was written to be, like, a really, like, nerdy, like, Woody Allen type, and then they just liked that actor and they cast him in it, which is bonkers because he's very good in that role.
Yeah, it was great. I loved him. He and the mom both tread a jet. And I think that one does end with another, like, final duo, which feels like a thing in Final Destination, where, like, it comes down to two. In Final Destination 2, it's that fucking cop and that teen, which, inappropriate. Teens shouldn't date cops. But
all right, hold on. First of all, the cop is played by Lois and Clark's Jimmy Olsen.
That doesn't mean he's not a cop. Fantastic.
And second of all, he did interviews where he said that there is not supposed to be any romantic tension between the two characters. I don't know if the movie itself buys that, but that's at least how he was trying to play it. Also, I think she's in college.
Okay.
I think. But not that that makes anything better. I just want to clarify.
You just want to intercede on behalf of Jimmy Olsen's honor, and I understand that.
I just love Jimmy Olsen so much, and he got fired from that show after season one because he looked too much like Dean Cain. Which is probably the only time anyone's been fired for that specific reason.
I would love you to be wrong about that. I would love that to be, like, a primary cause of firing in various Hollywood jobs. Like, or even just other jobs. Like, sorry, you can't be principal of this school anymore.
You look too much like Dean Cain.
Anyway, You are absolutely right. The Final Destination 2 does something different with the survivor clump. I think in other ways it does follow the formula of the ending.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Did you want to loop back to Devon Sawa jerking off before I forget?
I don't know if I have much to say. I just think that's... I feel like they're getting at something that... I feel like you don't accidentally include a scene where Devon Sawa, like, looks at a porno magazine and then decides to start jerking off. I don't know what they're trying to say with that, if they're trying to get at this, like, connection between, like, oh, well, all of his friends are dead, he wants to feel alive, or he's 17 and just wants to jerk off. I guess he throws the porno at the owl or whatever, and it gets chopped up in the fan, so maybe it's just purely functional, but I feel like there could have been another way to do that.
I mean, I assume they were combining the need to have, like, an augury with the need to have some tits in the movie. Sort of two birds, one stone, but in this case... I mean, it's true that you don't accidentally have a scene of jerking off. I think it's part of sort of the weird tone that they're, like, feeling, as it were, feeling out in Final Destination 1, where how much their teens matters varies.
Yeah.
Because to loop back to your idea of, like, young people think they're gonna live forever, their teenness matters to their experience of death in that more than I think it does in Final Destination 3, where they're teen so that they can have a high school setting.
Yeah.
But they don't otherwise seem to engage much with how young they are. Actually, I think 3 is interesting to me because there's a distinct lack of parenting that happens in it. Whereas in Final Destination...
there's no adults.
In Final Destination 1 and 2, parenting specifically is a thing. Except for Clear Rivers, all the teens are shown as having, like, involved in caring parents. And in Final Destination 2, there's the mom with the kid who does some, like, extreme parenting. And, like, we get that very sweet scene where she's, like, kissing him on the forehead and is like, dentist tomorrow, buddy, and being very, like, sweet about it.
Part 1 was actually, this may play into that idea that parenting as a theme on the DVDs, you know, there's deleted scenes. So there's an entire deleted subplot to the film that had a completely different ending originally.
What?
Where, yeah, so originally Devon Sawa dies.
Okay.
And, but earlier there is a sex scene between him and Clear. And
yikes.
At the end of the film, she's pregnant with Devon Sawa's baby, and that's like new life that's breaking the spell of the death, and she like names him Alex, and it's very like, the end of the movie is just like her like delivering this baby and being like, I'm a new mom, I survived, and I brought life into the world instead of wallowing in death now. And people hated that, so that they're like, oh, well, let's just kill off Dawson's Creek boy.
I hate that. My God.
Yeah, it wasn't a good ending.
I appreciate you clarifying that. Yeah. Okay. I'm about to make a claim that is borderline indefensible, but I'm going to make it anyway. So bear with me.
You know those are my specialty.
I think Devon Sawa jerking off to porno in that particular way emphasizes his youth and situates him as in a family context. I think tying it into the idea that he's, you know, a person with a family and that's part of 1, like a significant part of 1, in my opinion, and it's part of 2, and then by 3 it vanishes and you start to see the default unit of relationship in 3 through 5 is couple more than it is family.
It's so weird in 3, because there's so much about Mary Elizabeth Winstead and her sister, and they're at home constantly, and it is so bizarre to it's almost as if adult, it's like a Peanuts situation where there's just no adults in the entire house.
Yeah.
I can remember sitting there in the theater and, you know, there's just a couple of scenes in their household. And it's just like, this is so where are this girl's mom and dad?
It's sort of a wiping out of that, and not in the way that we get in Final Destination 1, Clear Rivers waiting around to see if anybody shows up for her.
I'm just going to say, I like Clear a lot. I really enjoy her character.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do want to know, presuming her hair is naturally brunette, as is depicted in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Who is dyeing her hair in the second one, considering she is so afraid of anything coming into her life?
It's an important question. Yeah, no, I think she's actually one of the most interesting characters in the series. And, like, as much as I think you're right that they do throw in twists in archetype characters, it feels like by 5, they've stopped writing characters.
Yeah, and I think 4 is definitely the 5 at least attempts some things, but 4 I think is the low point where the main foursome, the only one I can tell you anything about is the I'm dying, I'm trying guy, and all I can say is that he likes the bone.
He is and douche, that's his deal.
Yeah.
The
other 3, they're completely interchangeable.
Yeah, absolutely. They're distinguished by hair color, but that's it.
Yeah. I think that's a shame, because I think the characters in 1, 2, and 3 are actually, they're memorable, at least in minor ways.
Yeah, three is much broader strokes, but that doesn't mean they're uninteresting. It just means that they've fallen into type a little bit more. I mean, I am genuinely obsessed with those fucking teen goths. I could watch solo movies about those shitty fucking teens, and I don't know. They feel to me like they're pulled out of some Joss Whedon type shit, which is not a compliment. But I do enjoy it, so that's...
Yeah. The only other thing I just want to note, just because I think it's fascinating, or not fascinating, that's way too strong, but it's interesting, at least in terms of movies today, and that's that the first four movies all have consistent musical themes, and that's even though the composer, Shirley Walker, who did Batman the Animated Series, she died after part three, and they brought in Brian Tyler. But he brings back her themes, but, like, adds heavy metal guitars behind them. And it's really disappointing to me that part five, they just abandoned the musical hook that is present in the first four. Because it's just like, you guys made it so close to the end. Why didn't you just keep going?
Especially since the final one is mostly just a love letter to the rest of the franchise. From the credits, which are literally just a best of. Oh, yeah, you want to talk about those? Because you loved those. I was... largely indifferent, but you loved it, so.
So, quick backstory about my relationship to the Final Destination franchise, which I think speaks a lot as to why I love it so much, because I think I am definitely a person who will love something emotionally and then just try and reverse engineer a fake intellectual reason to like it so that I sound smart.
I think that's a really good and healthy way to engage with media, so.
So, I first saw the first Final Destination the year it came out on VHS, Thanksgiving Day, at my aunt's house on the eastern shore of Maryland, with all of my cousins piled into my aunt and uncle's bed, and we had rented the videotape and all watched it together in that bed.
That is so cute. I'm dead now from how cute that is.
And so I was 10 years old when I first saw the first Final Destination, which is maybe not the appropriate age. But also, like, the perfect age.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, we came out and, you know, they were still making Thanksgiving dinner. And at one point, my aunt, like, dropped a bowl and it shattered. And, like, me and all of the cousins are just like, Final Destination! Oh, shit! Final Destination 2 was actually the first, one of the first three movies I ever rented from Netflix when we got Netflix, like, DVD system. So that was back in 2003, I guess.
Yeah.
And my mom, like, went out on vacation, and my sister and I were like, we're going to rent an R-rated movie. And so we got Final Destination 2, because we had remembered enjoying the first one so much. And then after that, it became a tradition for me and my sister, who had now seen the first two together. So we went and saw 3, 4, and 5 in theaters together. And it's like, any time a Final Destination comes out, that's like, that is, like, our only, like, main bonding thing that we have, is that we like to go see Final Destination. The real roundabout way to say that, so I saw Final Destination 5 in theaters, in 3D. It does lose something without the 3D, because it was truly well done. This was not post-conversion, it was shot in native 3D. The director, Stephen Quayle, like, that was his first movie, but he had, like, grown up under James Cameron and, like, helped do the 3D stuff with Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got a Final Destination somehow. But so his opening credits, I don't know, they're just so satisfying just watching all the weapons, and it becomes kind of a fun game. And I think that's something Final Destination is really good at, which is gamifying the concept, like, the idea of watching this with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're always setting up these ideas that, you know, oh, well, if you could just figure out the clue, you can figure out how somebody's going to die. And then they give you the clues. And sometimes they don't play fair, like when Mary Elizabeth Winstead's just straight up looking at the wrong pictures.
Yeah.
It's like, well, this doesn't make any sense. Like, oh, we took another one. Okay, well, there are a whole bunch of aspects about Final Destination that do kind of gamify it. You know, the idea of, you know, what would I do in this situation? How would I try and protect myself? Mm-hmm. Like, just playing along with the characters, it becomes kind of a fun interactive thing. And the opening credits are very much that, because it's showing you objects that have killed people, and you get to kind of have that fun moment of thinking, all right, well, what movie is that from? Which death is that? And I don't know, it's just kind of fun putting all the pieces together. And then the end credits, which are just to AC/DC.
Yep.
And are just, yep, just straight up just showing clips from the earlier movies, only, yeah, this time they're in 3D.
Yeah.
It's just such a fun, happy celebration of everything that they've done. And then it ends with that, like, Tony Todd walking away and being like, see you soon. It's just such a perfect wrap up for everything. Just one last thing, and this is just a pet peeve of mine. People always, and I feel like people only say this because they hear other people say this. Everybody always describes the death as Rube Goldberg-like. And I just want to say, I don't think that that's true most of the time. Most of the time, it's fake. It's a bunch of fake outs, and then something actually kills somebody. There are very few circumstances where, like, a steadily escalating number of coincidences all come together to kill somebody.
Yeah. The tanning bed scene is almost a Rube Goldberg.
That's the one that I definitely think is.
The garbage disposal scene comes really close.
See, that's the one that originally made me think, oh, wait, no, these aren't, because there's, I guess, a Rube Goldberg machination, but then the death is that he steps outside and slips on spaghetti.
Yeah, I mean, that one and the... that's still... I couldn't even finish my sentence because it's still so funny. That one and the dentist are the significant ones where they do set up a Rube Goldberg trap, but then it doesn't matter at all. So...
yeah.
The Rube Goldberg happens, but it doesn't. It's not the cause of death. So your nitpicking is correct.
It's just one of those things. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think it's valid, and I think it's important to, because I keep coming back to, like, my ineptly phrased interest in the mechanics of death here. Partly because most saw traps are Rube Goldberg in some way, or, like, you have to make a choice that triggers it. You know, they're devices. And that's something that is decidedly not the case in Final Destination. That even though it's like a custom-made death, it's not a device in the same way. A lot of it is relatable, because it's just capricious fate set something off.
One of the interesting things about Final Destination 5 is that death seems less hands-on than maybe it got in 3 and 4, in that in 4 you end up having objects that are just straight up moving by themselves.
Yeah,
like there is just like a can of hairspray is just like for no reason sliding across the desk until it like heats up. But in part 5, anytime something is moving or like shaken loose, it's given a very specific reason to why it's doing that, to the point where it's almost as if death is not actually doing anything. It is just allowing that these coincidences that would normally happen, because before it's much more, it's, you know, there's always that the blow of the wind, and then that usually like kicks off something, or the water that's crawling towards you, and but in this it's like, you know, the air conditioning unit is spinning and that causes one of the screws to come loose.
Yeah, I was trying to think if there's any sort of counterexamples in the other Final Destinations of, like, careful mechanical explanations that way, but I don't really think so. I think for the most part, there's at least a certain amount of, like, death has explicitly decided it's time for you to be dead now.
I mean, I guess getting hit by a bus is just that could happen to anybody.
Yeah, that's true. That is a fact. That's a good note to close that on, I think. Anybody can get hit by a bus. Thanks for listening to the Mile Wide Club. Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this show. Do you want to tell the people where they can find you?
So I'm on Twitter at Jacob_DeNoble. That's DeNobel, like the Nobel Prize. That's what I always say, and my boss always makes fun of me for it. Yeah, and keep your ears open, because I think I'm going to be starting a podcast that is similar to the discussion we had about Final Destination, but about all sorts of different movie series and franchises, from your nerdier kind of stuff like Highlander or Alien or stuff that people talk about all the time, to the aforementioned Francis the Talking Mule, Ernest, Free Willy, but that should be coming probably around the end of the summer. So follow me on Twitter, and I'll probably be promoting it there.
Awesome. Thanks so much to Jacob for doing the show. You can find him on Twitter. You can find the podcast at myoloidclub.tumblr.com or myoloidclub.podomatic.com, or now on iTunes. You can find the Final Destination franchise wherever DVDs are sold, probably. And you can find a lot of motivation and spite, if that's where you're at right now. Okay, thanks so much. Bye.